Blog Talk Radio.
One of my good friends and comrades who has just made his transition to the elders, and that's none other than Brother Hudari Abdul Ali. And those of you who are from the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, you know his work very well. Hudari had a radio show on WPFW 89.3 in the Washington, D.C. area known as Freedom Sounds. And, you know, where he talked about a range of issues that the progressive, the corporate media seldom, if ever, even touches the surface. Hudari was a peacemaker. He was a peaceful brother. He, you know, spent much of his life fighting for peace and justice and equality for all people, especially those of us of African ancestry. He was originally from San Diego, California, and he came to Washington, D.C. as a student at Howard University. At Howard, he served as editor-in-chief of the campus newspaper, The Hilltop, then the only daily newspaper on an HBCU campus, a historically black college university. He went on to establish legendary political stores such as Pyramid Books and Dar Salaam Health Center. I mean, his books gave me, you know, he had one of those bookstores that that carried books that Barnes and Noble's, Borders, they don't carry. They don't carry, and on purpose they don't carry. Hodari carried those books in his bookstores, and so his bookstore, especially the Dar Salaam when it was in Mount Rainier, I used to frequent that place all the time and developed a friendship with him as somebody who's an educator in this area and who started a Books for Northern Uganda fund a campaign where we were able to send tens of thousands of brand new course-specific books to several schools in Northern Uganda. When Brother Hodari found out about that, he extended his hand to me and everyone working on the campaign. He had us come on his radio show and to promote the campaign. He allowed us to put bottles, fundraising bottles, in his stores to generate more revenue so that we could have enough money to send the books to Northern Uganda. He came on campus. He came. He participated in community forums around Islamophobia. Extended his hand to students, to college students, and students of all ages. He, you know, I could go on forever. It's been a very emotional day for me. Today was his funeral. It was in Washington D.C. at the Masjid Muhammad Mosque, which is located at 1519 Islamic Way, otherwise known as 14th Street, and if you were there, you would have seen, you know, one of the things I saw is that, you know, when I make my transition, man, if I can have half of the people, if I can do half of the things that Brother Hodari did, I mean, the people that came out to this, to his going home ceremony, if you will, today. It was an outpouring of love from people from all walks of life, Muslim and Christian and otherwise. You know, people came out to support a brother who had supported their community through so much of his life. And so, you know, we send our prayers with his family. He leaves four children, a wife, a loving wife, Ayana. He also so leaves six siblings, and if we can all send our prayers out to his family, and I know somewhere out there, Brother Hodari is looking down right now and can be very proud about the work and the legacy that he's left behind. He's left a tremendous, tremendous legacy, and this show is dedicated to him. You know, if you'd like to make a financial contribution to help his family, defray the cost of his medical costs as well as the funeral costs, you know, you can send an email to Sadiq, that's sadiq.akmal@gmail.com. Once again, that's sadiq.akmal@gmail.com. You can send an email there, and they can let you know how you can make a donation through PayPal. But as you know, with this capitalist society that we live in, Brother Hodari and his family shouldn't have had to pay a penny as he was fighting this progressive cancer that was that eventually took his life. But his spirit and his legacy will live on forever. So this story, this show is dedicated to Brother Hodari, and this show is if you tune in right now, you know the show is centered around institutional racism in America, and that's why we opened with American Nightmare. That was Brother Ali, who's a rapper based out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. From the Rhymesayers camp, and the second MC on that track was none other than the legendary Scarface from Houston, Texas, Rap-A-Lot. So this show is dedicated to Brother Hadari Abdul Ali. The show was, his birth date was June 3rd, 1955, and his transition date to the Elders was April 30th, this past weekend. So I'm going to do the best I can to hold it together. It's been a very emotional day for me. So without further ado, I want to introduce to the program Ms. Andrea Zamudio, who is the managing editor for Your World News, the media collective. If you don't know, you can go to our website. It's www.yourworldnews.org. That's www.yourworldnews.org. And we just launched this past week, and we're really excited about it. It's a media collective where we're trying to get the community to, involved. So if you are, if you'd like to be a correspondent or a writer and you have strong writing skills, we're looking for activists and organizers who have an inclination to write and to get the stories out there. We're not looking for writers first and activists second. We're looking for writers who are organizers and activists first. And, you know, we want folks that don't just necessarily do their work behind the keyboard and behind the microphone, but actually get out there with the boots on the ground and do what it's needed to engage themselves with the community. We can't stay behind, you know, our keyboards and our microphones and our computer screens. We have to get out there with the people. So if you're interested in being a correspondent or a writer or just supporting, you know, you can get at us. All right, Andrea's email. I'll let her give you her email, but my email, if you want to email, is just solo@yourworldnews.org. And hers is Andrea at yourworldnews.org. And I'll let her introduce herself. This is her maiden voyage, if you will, on Your World News. But she's going to join us on this program a lot more because she is the managing editor. So, but she's also an activist, and it's going to be important to have her on the show quite frequently to really dissect a lot of the stories, new stories that we're carrying on our website, and especially on the blog component of the website. So, Andrea, if you can introduce yourself to the listeners, who you are, and you know, why you're part of the Your World News team.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Andrea Zamudio. Like Solomon said, I will be working in this media collective. I am a social worker in D.C. for a community clinic that predominantly works with immigrant women and African American women. And I just think that, you know, to continue the legacy of people that have come before us, it's important to have these media collectives where we're allowed to have a voice and give venue to the issues that affect our communities, just like Brother Hadari did. And, you know, that's really the best way to honor people like him and everyone else that has passed. So, you know, today is going to be a great show. We're going to talk about institutional racism and what that really means. How is that different from, you know, personal prejudice and individual biases? How does that affect our lives, or particularly people of color? How does that affect our lives on a bigger scale than just being called certain words or, you know, not being treated in the most appropriate way when going into an establishment?
So, appreciate that intro, and you know, as you guys know, the loyal listeners, you know, I told Andrea before she came on here, we take the gloves off. We take the gloves off on this show, and we're hard hitting, and we're hard hitting because we need to make up for a lot of lost ground that has been caused by the corporate media and so many folks out there who have been programmed by the corporate media. And so, as she said, you know, we're going to be talking about institutional racism. So if you follow the corporate media and you follow, you know, corporate politicians in Capitol Hill, and especially the white corporate media, that's what I'm talking about. And yes, there are some as Malcolm would say, I think would describe some handkerchief head Negroes out there who really want to push this whole thing that we're living in a post-racial society. And really the proper term, it would be post-racist society. But we are living in a post-racist society. Institutional racism is amok. And the reason why it's so important for shows like this and dialogues that you can carry with you, and if you want to call in, you know, excuse my manners, the call-in number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. If you're listening live, you probably already know the number because it's on the webpage. But this show is so important, and this dialogue is so important because, for instance, a couple of years ago, ABC did a program dealing with you know, quote-unquote racism. So they went down south, one of the parts they went, and they sent a, it was beautiful, it was a really, really sharp and clever thing that they did, sending a black female reporter down south. And what was kind of telling to me is that she had them ask a bunch of young black boys and girls if they've ever, you know, if they've ever experienced racism. You know, they think racism still exists, you know, with the onset of the first, you know, African-American president. And some of the kids said, no, you know, I've never been called a nigger. I've never been called a name, you know, been made fun about my color. And that was the point of contention. But these kids came from extremely poor communities in Mississippi, if you know Mississippi, all right, you know, the poorest state in the union. Many of these African-American kids came from extremely impoverished communities. So when you have that, you frame it like that, and they cleverly framed it like that. When you frame the question like that, especially to a young boy or a young girl, that they have no basis. There's no dialogue that looks into the racist roots, the institutional racism that has kept their communities impoverished since their granddaddies and their great granddaddies and their great great granddaddies' lives. That's institutional racism. That is without a doubt institutional racism. We look at this, and I want to set the stage for this dialogue. But we look at 2011. For every dollar of wealth that a white person has, for every dollar of wealth that a white family has, a black family has a dime of wealth, a dime. Latinos, it's something like 12, 13 cents to every dollar. So it's these kind of things. So is it because we just don't work hard enough? Is it because blacks and Latinos, you know, I'm specifically talking about indigenous Latinos, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, when you fill out the application, we don't pay attention to it. Non-white Hispanic, non-white Latinos. We have to understand that Latino is a cultural term. It's not a racial, it's not a race category. So I'm talking about indigenous Latinos or mestizos, you know, those folks who when you look phenotypically, you can tell that they are the descendants of the original owners and proprietors of North America, South America, Central America, even the Caribbean. No, it has nothing to do with that they don't work hard enough or that African Americans don't work hard enough. All right, the roots are institutional racism. The prison industrial complex is another one. Warehouses more black men today than they did in 1850. Michelle Alexander has you know, did a piece about this, you know, some weeks back. But her book, a brilliant book, The New Jim Crow, had an opportunity to read this. These things are inextricably linked to institutional racism. And I ask you, Andrea, you know, before we go to a clip, because there's a panoply of clips from Black Agenda Report that I want to use to kind of set the tone and tenor for much of the conversations that we're going to have in the next, you know, hour and 40 minutes. But I want to ask you this question, Andrea. How you're originally from Colombia. You study a lot. You've done a lot of work around around immigration rights and those type of things. And you've also just written a piece that's gotten a lot of traction. You submitted it a week ago. It's actually on the yourworldnews.org website, talking about immigration reform, the DREAM Act, and you took a very, what I would say, an unpopular position. And I think that's good because in this case, as we looked last, we'll get into that, but if you look around, most Americans, they get their calling cards in terms of what to think from the corporate media. They're like Pavlov's dogs. They're waiting, they're panting, and when the corporate media rings the bell, you know, they start to salivate and they take their marching orders for what to do. America is filled with a lot of mindless folks who have been programmed since day one. Since day one, when they stepped into a public educational school, since day one, when they started to watch TV, they've been programmed, mindlessly programmed. If they don't have parents that have broken it up, and most of them, their parents are about that same system. And I can digress and get into some other things, but I want to ask you, what role do you think the whole myth, and this is the framework that we want to work with. There's a very famous adage that goes, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was to convince the world that he did not exist. The greatest trick, I repeat, that the devil ever pulled was to convince the world that he did not exist. We use that as our thesis statement and our point of departure, comparing and contrasting that to blacks and Latinos who have drank the Obama Kool-Aid, who have taken their marching orders from white folks, that you know what I'm saying, you live in a post-racist society now. You have a black president. There is a black president. You live in a post-racist. And the reason why you are poor, the reason why you are poor is because you did not work hard enough. You need to pull yourselves up by the bootstraps. That is the devil. That is the devil. The devil is institutional racism, and if we don't see it for what it is, it will continue. It will continue to cause wreck and havoc and evil in the form of death and impoverishment and a whole range of things that fall under the occupation of institutional racism. Your thoughts?
Well, I would just say that along with that, you know, multiculturalism and diversity are these buzzwords that are really put out there in schools and in our workplaces. And, you know, there's all these cultural trainings in schools. You know, universities boast about how they're, expanding their diversity and number of African-American students or Latino students, et cetera. But those words have really, they're not addressing the issues. They really just give the illusion that we are in that post-racist society that you were talking about, that things are okay, when in reality it prevents us from seeing what still continues today, this institutional racism that prevents students from going to college at the same rate because of tuition fees. And so I think that, you know, it's important to realize the issues that we're facing. And when we have, you know, when there's these events, multiculturalism or diversity, like, what does that really mean? What are these events discussing? Because most of the time they're just, brown bag events where you can come and talk about what type of food you eat and the music that you dance to, but not really how your community is being affected by things like the police or why you don't have access to healthy food. So I feel like we have to stop. It's not a time where we can all hold hands. And yes, race is a social construct, but it has become a reality, and you can't erase 500 years plus of institutional racism by just pretending that it doesn't exist anymore.
Right. Good point. And it looks like we have a caller, so I want to actually have the caller in. You know, I was going to play the Glenn Ford clip, but want to welcome the caller to the program, and Carl, if you could, give your, well, looks like our caller, I don't know if they got camera shy or microphone shy, but they just exited stage left, so I don't know if you had an issue with your phone or what have you, but If you're out there, call back in. It seems like we had a caller from Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas area. If you want to call back in, please do. Once again, the number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. And that was a great segue, Andrea. And I want to actually, because we can break this down into a couple different areas today. We can break down, number one, housing, and connect that to institutional racism. And folks, this is where the gloves come out, because as long as we take our orders from the bloody corporate media in the U.S., we will continue to have a status quo, the status quo that they benefit from. They and their corporate, you know, fornicators benefit from day in, day out. And their political fornicators who also are in the form of politicians. They benefit from the status quo, the Democrats and the Republicans, all right? Because Latinos didn't just merely vote for Barack Obama because he was black. That's like saying that everyone would have voted for Clarence Thomas. Every black person would have voted for Clarence Thomas, he ran. The reason why so many blacks and Latinos voted for him is because he ran as a Democrat, which is something that, you know, blacks and Latinos alike need to get off that whole myth, thinking the Democratic Party has done anything for us lately in any shape, form, or fashion. They don't even address in their platform, their national platform, institutional racism or anything like that. All right, I know they're not going to touch white supremacy, but even institutional racism. So actually, our caller is back on. So caller, you're on the air. Your question or comment?
Oh,
hello,
I'm here. Good afternoon. Can I be heard?
Yes, you can. You're on with Andrea and Solomon.
Good afternoon, Solomon and Andrea. This is my first time calling into your show, but I've been a regular listening to your podcast. I subscribe, and I was wondering what happened to you for the past month. I thought they had kicked you off the Block Talk Network. So I was very, very surprised when I got my reminder in the mail that your show was on for tonight.
Right,
so thanks
right.
For having
me. And I'll tell you this, and I'll say this really quickly. I totally understand you making that assumption, because with the content that we deal with, I would have made that assumption that they would have booted us off as well. But what's kept me off air for such a long time is that I'm in the midst of a major community organizing campaign right now, and that's one of the things that I pride myself on, is being a community activist and organizer. So it's been taking a lot of my time, and it's something I'm working around with some workers' rights. Primarily black and Latinos who have been who are customarily being treated like crap, being paid unlivable wages, at the same time being referred to as boy and being called everything from nigger to hoe to everything like that. And so it's consumed a lot of my time. Yeah. So, but we're back better than ever.
Well, thanks a lot, Solomon and Andre, because I quite agree with you on what you're doing, because everyone seems to think that the this black president has taken the word community organization and put it to a whole new level, and people only think that you would only be a community organizer if you're Barack Obama. They're not realizing that we were doing organizing before this man was even into existence, breathed into existence by his father, that we have always been organizers in our community. So it's fantastic work that you're doing, and I'm glad that you're doing, because what we are seeing now with this diversity issue that you're bringing up is that they are putting the Latinos and the blacks to fight against each other over a labor issue that was created by the white supremacy. And we're having some of the Latinos who are buying into it, and they're feeling that, okay, in order for them to be discriminatory towards blacks and take on the white supremacy role of demoralizing each other, is going to somehow or the other give them a bigger piece of the crumb from off of the table. Because this
right.
is, in essence, what's being done. And I live in the Dallas area, and I'm quickly, and this is what happened last weekend. I was on my way coming back from Austin, and I happened to watch a state trooper had a Latino family pulled along the side of the road. This man was dressed in full military regalia with combat boots, uniform, looks like a uniform and everything. He had these people pulled to the side of the road, the parents, the children in handcuffs, their stuff tossed all over the road, and I know if it was a white family, they would not have been treated in that manner. And it was a white police officer. So I could sympathize with what the Latinos are going through in this state, which was once a part of Texas. They seem to forgot that this was a part of the state of Texas, or was a part of the state of Mexico.
Right. You're exactly right. I mean, that I'm so glad you brought that up, because yeah, if they were white, they wouldn't be preyed upon, they wouldn't have been stopped in such a manner. And this goes on, and that's what you saw, and this goes on in every area where there's a concentration of blacks and Latinos in this country. It throughout, whether it's in that area or D.C. or Baltimore,
New York,
or South L.A., it's going on everywhere.
And what this is doing, it is pitting us when we could come together. First and foremost, I don't know how the guest feels about being referred to as Latino, because what I like to let them know, this is a new term that was coined by the civil rights movement. You people are really indigenous people who happen to have the title or carrying the Spanish name of your former oppressors that you are wearing and some of their blood running through your veins. And now you want to distinguish yourself as Hispanic, Latinos, or whatever, when you could classify yourself as indigenous people, because that is why they're saying the Native Americans there are less than 5% of the total U.S. population, when it's not, and they're saying the Latino population is growing. Y'all are really and truly indigenous people, and you need to claim your identity and stop trying to identify yourself as your former oppressors who raped your ancestors and give you the names and titles that you're walking around in.
Bravo.
You're absolutely right. I couldn't have said it better myself. It really is an issue. And like I said in the beginning of the show, I work at a community clinic, and with a lot of the immigrant population, they're mostly from Central America. And I face this issue because we have to ask them about race. And so I face that a lot, where my community just doesn't really think about that, or identifies, almost wants to identify with white culture, as to feel like they're assimilating, just like you discussed. But I wanted to ask you, how do you feel that black and brown people can come together? Like, what do you think that our communities can do to bridge that gap?
We have a common goal in mind. We have economics and racial discrimination that's been put against us. And what they're trying to do is to say, because your shaded skin is lighter, your hair is a bit straighter, closer to white supremacy, therefore, we're going to treat you a little bit better. You're not like them. Their skin is darker. Their hair is much tighter to the scalp. So, therefore, they're going to pull one or two out and set you up in such a way, and you're going to feel privileged for having this attention and being treated so-called better than the others, which is what you see with a light-skinned, dark-skinned Latino, because you have more white blood running through your veins, which has caused the schism within the community like it's done in the black community. If you should say, I have no choice in how I turn out because of the rapes that took place during my ancestral line, this is how I happen to be here, and this is how I look like I am. Take on your identity and say, we have a goal. We need to overturn this system of white domination. I don't like to use the word supreme, because it makes you seem as if you're all powerful. They're only powerful because they're underhanded, they're deceitful in how they go about doing things. They don't want to stand up and face you and do things to your face. They like to do it behind your back. As Dr. Clark said, the great ancestor, Dr. John Henry Clark said, he said, white people don't know the meaning of fractions. They know the whole damn thing. They want to take the whole thing. They don't believe in fractions.
You're right. That's so good. Sister, what's your name?
My name is Sarah.
How you doing? This is your first time calling in, but I hope you call in so much more, because we need that kind of knowledge and wisdom. I feel we all have something to contribute, and people might underestimate the power of thought and conversation and things that just like things that you brought up. But every revolution, every major movement, it started with thoughts and ideas. People vocalizing and ideas, in terms of what they needed to do as an organization or as a community to really begin that protracted fight and that struggle that led towards that kind of change. And you're right, it's until we start, and that's one of the things, we have to reclaim our identity, black folks here, we are more African than we are American, and that's one of the
right.
things I loved about Malcolm. He explained that to a T and created the analogy. We are not sitting at that metaphorical table that he created, when he was talking about, if you're that doesn't make you a diner. If you're sitting at the table and you have nothing on your plate, and everyone's just facing the stand, no, you're just sitting there. You're just sitting there. And
right now,
blacks and Latinos, we are not diners. We are not feasting on the same civil liberties and the same human rights that our white counterparts are feasting on.
You're quite right, because either you are a diner sitting at the table, or you are the meal that's going to be dined on.
Ooh,
and so far,
yeah.
We have been the meal, and we
You're
have
right.
not gotten anything from it. So we need to come together, put all of these titles that have been created by the white domination in order to create this schism amongst us, throw up these titles, come together, and that's what they don't want. They don't want this great force to come together. Now the Arabs over there are going through their bit of turmoil, and they thought that they were so close to the white domination. Now they are seeing that they were only used because of what they have. We all need to come together, because we are more of this earth than these so-called minorities, the real minorities who have been in control of it.
You're right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Sarah, and I look forward to hearing from you. And I'll give you my email in a second. So just tune in. I'm going to give you our email so you can email us, and we can
listen to the rest of the show. And thanks again, Andrea, for coming on, and Brother Solomon, glad you were back.
All right, thanks.
Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
That made my day. That made my day. Sometimes when I'm feeling down, man, that she made my day. And Sarah, our emails, Andrea's email is andrea@yourworldnews.org, and mine is solo@yourworldnews.org. And if you want to get put on the listserv, you can just email us at either one of those emails, and we'll get you put on the listserv, or you can email us at yourworldnews2010@gmail.com. I know it's a lot, or you could just simplify things and just go to the website yourworldnews.org. But I really hope to hear from Sarah again. I mean I love connecting to folks, different geographical regions. Who get it, because that means that wherever Sarah is in that area of Texas, that there are people that she's going to come in contact with, where she's going to give that insight and that knowledge, and that's where it starts. Well, it looks like we have another caller, and I'll take this call because they've been waiting so patiently. Caller, you are on the air. Can you hear me? Seems like our caller has some technical difficulty. Hopefully they'll call back in. But with that being said, I want to play something from Black Agenda Report, something on gentrification and its impact on African Americans in this country. And on the other end, hopefully the other caller from the 916 area code will give us a call back and we can go from there. But this is Glenn Ford on Black Gentrification.
The corporate news media greeted new census data detailing the drastic and general decline of black populations in center cities as if the phenomenon were somehow a vindication of the American dream, a cause for celebration. The dramatic increase in the movement of African Americans back to the South, which actually began decades ago, is held up as proof positive that America's racial conflicts will soon be a thing of the past. Newsrooms seem filled with jubilation that the nation's cities will soon be liberated from two generations of concentrated black presence. Underlying the upbeat news coverage is the assumption that a diffusion of blacks is, by definition, a good thing for the nation as a whole and for black people themselves. It also assumes, against all relevant evidence, that this mass movement of black people from New York City, Chicago, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Detroit, Oakland, and so many other cities is totally voluntary, that economic push-out has played no major role in emptying the cities of blacks and sending hundreds of thousands down to Dixie. It is an absurd assumption by journalists whose elation at the black exodus compels them to ignore gentrification as one of the main factors. People who are priced out of the cities by gentrification cannot be considered voluntary migrants. Gentrification has become an overarching fact of black urban existence, making life less tenable every day, especially in New York. It is no wonder that 17% of blacks that relocated to the South in the past decade were New Yorkers, far more than from any other state. When gentrification places the monthly rent hopelessly out of reach, there is no choice but to leave. And why not South, where it's cheaper and there are so many people who look like you, some of whom are related? Those who would characterize the Black Southward movement as overwhelmingly voluntary and non-economic speculate that folks are going South to be near family. But family has always been there. Why the big rush to join them now? There is literally no statistical basis in U.S. Census data to conclude that the urge to strengthen family ties is an important factor in reverse black migration. But white corporate media and the types of black folks that work for it have no problem substituting their own favorite scenarios for real data and real facts. Black movement from inner cities to the suburbs is also intertwined with gentrification. It is not only the poor who are pushed out, but also better-off families and singles for whom city life is no longer viable. But all suburbs are not alike. Study after study shows that blacks more often wind up just outside the borders of the central city in older suburbs, many of which have the characteristics of inner-city ghettos without the conveniences and urban amenities. Such suburbs hug the edges of Washington, Chicago, and Detroit. Other suburbs may appear to be racially integrated today, but that is only a snapshot in time. These places will be much blacker or browner tomorrow because of white flight, the root source of segregation in America. Whites are also in flight from the truth that the deeply racial dynamic of gentrification is forcing many black folks to cheaper suburbs and the lower-cost South, including many blacks that claim the move is strictly voluntary. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Andre, I want to ask you, just based on the work that you do in Washington, D.C., Monday through Friday, in relationship to what Glenn Ford was just talking about, can you explain to our listeners, especially like those listeners that we have that do not reside within the Washington D.C. metropolitan area, and we know that what you're about to explain is very similar story all over the country. But what have you seen as the impact? What are things that you've noticed with gentrification in Washington D.C. specifically?
I haven't been in D.C. for a long time, but the changes are drastic. Like, every year you just see it changing constantly. So I work in Columbia Heights, a neighborhood in northwest D.C. that was predominantly black, and then a lot of Latinos, especially Salvadorians, came in the 80s. Every time you see a white architect in any neighborhood, you know it's going to start changing, and slowly... it definitely has. On the street where the clinic is, it was predominantly Latino and black. And, every other house now, it's either, a townhouse that's been renovated, and it's just, completely unaffordable to anyone who used to live there. Or it's a condo, which is the same, just completely unaffordable to any of the old residents. And so you just see this influx of young white people coming to work in the city. And, a lot of the women that I've talked to have told me, the building has been bought out by a different person. They've renovated it, and now they're condos. And one woman in particular told me that her rent was going up, I think, $400, $500 in just, one swoop. And it's interesting because at first, I was like, this can't be legal. But the more I talk to, one of the lawyers that we have on staff, it really depends on what code the building has and, certain percentages. And the lawyer was explaining to me that in all actuality, most buildings aren't coded in a certain way where tenants can be protected. So, this isn't, that's institutional. and that's what we're talking about, and that is racism, because you're moving, you're forcing Black and Latino people out of their neighborhoods, and now, you know, a lot of times, like Glenn Ford was saying, they have to move to these suburbs, but they're older suburbs where they have to now commute to work if they work in the city. So, you know, it's really changed a lot. In Columbia Heights, I know about 5 years ago, they tore almost an entire, you know, entire couple blocks down and made a Target, a Best Buy, a health center. They put in a ton of restaurants, nothing that existed before, Whole Foods, Yes Market on Georgia Avenue, in the Petworth area. And, you know, these grocery stores don't exist in Black and Latino neighborhoods. But all of a sudden, when there's an influx of white people in the community, then all these stores start popping up.
And I'm glad you mentioned that because, yeah, you don't see a lot of those stores in Black and Latino communities. And the options for eating, you know, fried chicken place here, chicken box place here, you know, fried chicken this. I mean, things that over time, you know, contribute to your demise as a human being. You will die a lot sooner if you eat those kind of foods. But then, you know, the insensitive person that just wants to think of things as being, you know, this or that, and no real, like, you know, serious divulgement into the intersectionalities that connect that is that, you know, you have people that live, you know, for instance, in Washington, D.C., Ward 7 or Ward 8, you know, in order to go to the Whole Foods or some of these other places, you know, you're talking, and they don't have any automobiles, you know, you're talking about taking a couple buses and having a bus transfer here and there just to get there. And how many bags of groceries are you going to be able to carry back? And so you look at the options within the grocery stores that are in these communities. And then you look at the wages that these people are making. They're not making livable wages. They're living off of wages that, quite frankly, you know, put people in a position where they might not necessarily want to, but they have to go and buy, you know, those 10 packs of ramen noodles for a dollar. All right, okay? With the 1,000 milligrams of sodium per. Yeah, and the other half is, yeah, you know, a lot of folks aren't educated in terms of eating right. But even when you're educated in Iran, if you're living in that community with that kind of minimum wage, you know, with a family of three or four, you know, let's face it, you are going to. I've been in that position recently. You know what I'm saying? Where I'm definitely not as suffering as bad as some of our brothers and sisters. But you know, there's been times where you know I really have to, like, you know, in order to stretch my dollar a little bit further. You know, I have to get something that, you know, I know is not necessarily as healthy as something that, you know, that I would like to purchase at a organic store or this, that, and the other. And these are the kind of things that we have to think about collectively as a community, folks. And it's not about even, like, to the point of going to beg the white man because, quite frankly, I don't leave it to white field folks to actually, you know, go and push for these stores in Black communities. If you notice, these stores, and Andrea, have you seen, we've had these discussions off air, these stores all of a sudden start to pop up when gentrification starts to pop up. So when they know white folks are going to start moving in, you start to see the erection of a this market and then that market, and they just happen to be, you know, healthy and this and that. But we need to look at how we support one another, how we support local stores and vendors who are Black and Latino, how we support them, how we support the creation of Black and Latino organic markets and stores. And they're out there. They are out there. But we have to look at how we support them and you know, at the same time, you know, feeding our bodies properly, but also this on the other token, we're looking at building up our economies within those communities where we have a real strong, you know, steady economy going that's cooperative and so forth. Just some things to think about. I see we have a couple callers on the line, so I'm going to put one person on and the person in the Sacramento area. If you can just hold on, I'll be connecting you in 1 minute. But caller, this caller from Parts Unknown, you're on the line.
Okay,
hello?
Is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Okay. Well, I just got here, so I heard what the woman was saying about how neighborhood where Salvadorians or whatever they were pushed out. And then you started talking about how you're supposed to support black and Latino neighborhoods. Why wasn't this neighborhood supported before, I wouldn't call it gentrification, but let's say the moving out of these people with the creation and construction of new buildings? Why weren't they supported before the new buildings came in?
Is that a question? And when you, just if I can just ask you, a lot of, when you say black or El Salvadorians or Salvadorians, as it's properly termed, or whatever they are,
okay,
it's kind of like an insensitive way to go at it. But also we can get into also why so many Central Americans came here in the 80s, which is connected to U.S. foreign policy. And so forth. And that's a discussion that I'd love to get into. But I'll let Andrea take a stab at that, since I think that question is geared towards you.
Are you asking why there wasn't this reconstruction occurring before white people came in?
No, you're talking about how this particular neighborhood was uprooted because construction of new buildings and then new shops came along, right?
Right. Yes.
Okay, and you're making the point that it's racism. I'm not saying it is or it isn't. I don't know. I don't know the ins and outs of that. What I'm asking is, when the gentleman host was talking about, well, you've got to support communities like these, then why wasn't this particular community supported in such a way that would have prevented the construction of the new buildings?
I would say that there probably wasn't the organization in the community at the time to defend the existing black and Latino neighborhoods. There are organizations now that exist that are fighting for tenant rights, that are fighting for against gentrification, like Empower DC. But I don't know. I wasn't there when it started. I would just assume that there wasn't the necessary organization that needed to occur, and it's just evolved. And just to point out why I do think it's racial. And it doesn't happen just in D.C., This is all over inner cities. And so when a neighborhood, the value of the property starts to get low, developers show interest in it because they can buy a piece of land for a very minimal amount and then build a high-rise condo and sell each condo for $500,000, right? And so the people in the community already living there paying, like Solomon said, getting minimum wage, working two jobs, are not going to be able to afford a $500,000 condo.
Mm-hmm. So why don't, organizers of black and Latino executives come together and do the same thing, move into neighborhoods which are devalued and then build them up?
I mean, there are, upper middle class or upper class black and Latino executives who do. And that ties into class. It's not just race. I mean, they're intersections, class and race.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the folks that are in the upper class or upper middle class that are black and Latino have really isolated themselves from the problems in their communities and have really, sold out and are not concerned with bringing up their communities. They are concerned with living well and, really assimilating to white society.
Or maybe just living well. Or, assimilating to be white. Who knows? The thing is that if a bunch of people have been in a certain neighborhood for a number of years, I would practically guarantee there were probably organizers in that neighborhood who try to get people together, and people don't get together. So if
I think it's difficult to organize people who, are working multiple jobs and have are facing a number of issues. I don't think that it didn't exist. I think it's just very hard, especially considering the amount of power that these corporations have and the political loot that they have in these communities. It's not a simple task to take on, multi-million dollar corporations.
Have you ever thought about what you could do in whatever community you're in?
Yeah, I've done it. I've tried to do it. Years ago, before I moved out of a neighborhood full of immigrants, I got together with people, and we picketed our landlord, and then we served him with papers, and I've done other politically active things. So, yeah, it is very hard, extremely hard. The thing is that if people are not willing to protect themselves, even the neighborhood I'm in now, people aren't willing to protect themselves from an incoming surge of immigrants. So people get.
And when you mean immigrants, are you talking about folks from Eastern Europe or Canada, those kind of immigrants, or are you specifically targeting
people
brown
from Europe.
Immigrants from south of the border, the so-called
people from
border?
People from Europe and a few from south of the border, people who don't speak English, people with peasant backgrounds, people who come into a neighborhood and do not bring the neighborhood up. Yeah. So
really.
Yeah, really. And if you want to get to
really,
that,
really.
Yeah,
so you're
really.
Saying, so it seems like you're saying that you think that you know, immigrants, a country that is basically not founded on immigrants, because this country has been founded on theft and plunder of white barbarians that came and brought disease and brought murder.
I agree with you on that.
And,
I agree with you,
you have no choice but to agree with me, because that's a fact. You can disagree with me, you can be a fool, or yes, you can say the obvious. I wasn't saying it for your approval, because it is.
And I wasn't saying it just to get your approval either. I'm saying it as
all right.
a
well,
fact.
Well, that's fine. But the way you're phrasing
the way I'm saying it is that most
immigrants and they're bringing it down
south
and this
of
and
the border.
Other. If you have such a damn problem with immigrants. Why don't you take? No, I'm asking you a question.
Let me
why
ask
don't
you a question. Do you think
well,
that
no,
most
let me finish.
Immigrants
let me
who
finish.
Come here?
What are you saying to your government, who played a major role in these Central Americans having
what
to flee their homes because Reagan
then,
and
yeah,
Bush
then it's imperialism.
Under the
so
Contras,
what?
And so what? So
what's
what?
That got to do with the immigration
what,
problem?
What do you mean? What that has to do with
here?
You can't just look at something being black and white. I'm not talking about even race when I say
no,
black and white.
No, what you're doing, you're trying
but,
to compare apples with oranges. I'm talking
no,
about
no,
immigrants.
No, I'm actually not comparing apples and oranges. What you're doing is you're looking at something very short-sighted, and that's the
very
problem
short-sighted,
with
huh?
most Americans. They want to look at things very short-sighted, and they don't want to
no,
look at
no, it's not short-sighted.
They don't want to look at the broader
most
context of
immigrant neighborhoods. Okay. Who have people?
Well,
who don't
how about
speak wait,
listen? Have you been to a rundown? Have you been to a trailer park that is predominantly white? Have
no,
you, have
I
you
haven't.
Been to,
and if they
you
and
haven't.
Those trailer
well,
parks,
well, you might want to go there and see,
well,
see
go
how
there.
They look.
If they
and,
don't
and,
speak
and how,
English, if they don't have employable skills, if they can't speak English properly, and they're functionally illiterate. They bring down their neighborhoods.
So you don't connect.
Back.
You don't connect institutional racism to functional skills and. The schools that are go vastly underfunded because they're connected to property values and these types of things.
Well, they are
and
connected to property values of the people in certain neighborhoods bring down their neighborhoods because the majority of those people in the neighborhoods do not have good jobs, do not have college educations, can't advance in the corporate world, do not know how to found businesses. Then what do you think is going to happen to those neighborhoods?
The corporate world. So wait a minute. They're here. So you what? If
yeah.
It was
so
up
what's
to
your
you,
point?
You,
they're
you,
here
them,
and they're not
no,
doing
yeah,
exactly.
No. You have a choice.
Back
so
to the American dream. You want
them,
people
would you
from
like,
all over
would
the
you
country?
Support them or would you like to put the money?
Do not know how to speak English.
Would you like? Are you willing
to speak English? Who
listen,
can't advance economically?
I'm not going to have.
Who
this
bring
is my
down
show.
Neighborhoods?
You know what?
You're saying
this
that's not a fact.
What's
are you saying that's not a fact? If you
what
go
is not a
to,
fact?
If you read, you know, if you read,
sir,
if
sure,
you like
if you would be quiet for a second, then I can respond.
Well, I've tried
what
to
you're
stay
asking
quiet,
me.
But you talk over me, so I figured like talking
but, and,
over
and
you.
And you talk over me, so as well. But you know what? This is not a democracy right now. This is my show, and so.
And why don't you get to the
I,
point
you know,
before I
you
get
can either,
really
you can
bored.
Either sit tight for a second, and let me rebut, or we can end the call right
all
now.
All right,
and,
I'm here. Go ahead.
Okay, so. You asked me if I think that immigrants, if they bring the – and my question before you asked that, I said, what do you find a solution to be? Would you be willing to – are you thinking about either deporting these people, just having them – just deporting them, or are you willing to, as a society, put the money into their community so that these people have the skills that they need to so-called contribute to society and where they're a part of communities and they're a part of well-funded schools – where they're getting these so-called job skills that folks get from well-to-do neighborhoods get.
All right. So millions of dollars have been poured into these schools over decades. What's the result?
Andrea?
What schools? Because I know you're not talking about the schools in immigrant communities or black neighborhoods, because that money has not been poured into those communities. If you, Selman was just talking about property taxes, you understand that the amount of money that your property is worth is going to be taxed, and so obviously the more your property is worth,
yes,
then
property taxes
have more
go
going to those schools.
Yes,
so in these areas, it's mostly low income areas, and the housing is rented. So the property taxes is going to be considerably lower, and these schools are going to be considerably underfunded.
The lower the property taxes, comparatively speaking, the schools theoretically don't produce students which are as good as those which are better funded. But those particular schools which do have low property taxes also get federal grants. So millions of dollars, such as No Child Left Behind, and the current President Obama's plan, I forget the name of his educational thing, pours billions of dollars into education. So what's the result?
Oh, really?
Oh, no, he hasn't.
Huh? Billions of dollars. All right, you tell me, because this is a wheelhouse I like to get in. So you're a strong advocate for No Child Left Behind and also Race to the Top. So you think that in your capitalist wet dreams it's somehow
so what do you want?
A good
you
idea
want money?
To hold a limited bag of billions of dollars over the heads of communities, which it is
a
very limited.
First off, you're complaining you didn't get money. I'm telling you the sources where you got money, and now you're complaining that the money isn't doing any good.
Listen, first of all, Obama and his administration are not willy-nilly pumping billions of dollars into school systems right now. All right, there's a catch. They are corporatizing these school systems. They are turning them into charter schools that are run by Wall Street hedge fund managers
that have dollar signs over every single child that
occupies these schools. All right,
then what about
it comes at a great cost to public education in every single one of those communities.
So the prior
that is a fact.
All right, and the prior administrations like Clinton and Bush, when they've been pouring money into schools, I think the budget for education has increased, every year?
Listen, what do you think about the military budget, buddy? What do you think?
Wait a minute, how come every time you ask
buddy
me a question, I give you an answer, and then I give you a counter question? You got to go off and do it.
No, it is a counter. I'm asking you, what do you think
do you
about
know,
the military budget?
Okay, you don't want to go on education anymore. All right, so
no, I'm asking you in comparison, because you think that there's a whole bunch of money that, do you know what was allocated towards education this year? I can tell you that. I'm just asking you. I want to see what I'm dealing with. I mean, what area are you calling from right now?
Montana.
Montana. Okay, Montana. Can I also ask you, are you of European extraction? Are you a white man? Not that it matters, but I just want to know.
I'm an American, dude.
You're American. Are you of European extraction? Are you of indigenous extraction from the Western Hemisphere?
Well,
are you of African extraction?
What I am isn't important. It's what I say.
It actually is. It has a lot to do because what you are.
So in other words, you're saying that whatever somebody says,
how you've been socialized, and your limited prism in which you're outlining things.
So you don't want to pay attention
to
logic
frankly,
or critical
and
thinking.
Not to say
you just
that
want
to
go ahead with
folks in
sophistry and arguments
anyways,
that don't make
we've
sense.
We've had enough of this. Thank you for your call, but I'm not going to continue to go around and around when you're not willing to look at facts.
You
talk about the money that's being put into education, but you can't even tell me how much money was earmarked for this fiscal year for education.
Are you
going to
stop?
Yeah, what is it?
What's what?
How much money was earmarked for education this year?
I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll tell you. Roughly about $75-77 billion. All right, for the entire country. All right, has been earmarked for education, and that is if certain things fall into place. What was earmarked for defense? What's being spent on defense? Which has everything to do You can't. They are not mutually exclusive. They are inextricably connected. All right.
But yeah, if, you're going what, to say that the money which is being poured into defense could
if
be
you
poured
work in this
into
country,
education.
54% of your taxes go towards military. Go to about $1 trillion. That is
what does
spent
that have
on
to do
military
with the,
every year. It has
what does that have to do with
to
the quality of education of the kids?
It has everything to do with it. And you call from your safe environment over in Montana without having spent any long time, and you call on the show quite frankly on this disrespectful like token, these Salvadorians, whatever they call themselves. You know,
whatever they call
I've had
them,
enough
I don't know what they call
of this conversation. You know what I'm saying? Because if you can't speak about people in terms that give some dignity to who they are and their identity, okay? Because if someone just wants
so
to
you can call them El Salvadorian, so you can call them anything you want. The fact is, most immigrants, when they come over here, are from peasant backgrounds.
From peasant backgrounds.
Right.
Peasant grounds. And what made them peasant backgrounds? What made them peasant backgrounds? You know, you were
lack of college
one.
Education, lack of employability.
No, they're peasant backgrounds that they come from. What made them peasant backgrounds?
What made
were they born peasants?
Are you going to talk about the war machine?
What made them peasant
backgrounds? Is that what you're
going
to say?
I asked you a question. What made them peasant backgrounds?
Their environment.
Their environment. What made those environments peasant backgrounds? Because they come from fertile land. They come from very arable land that has a lot of natural resources. Why don't their communities? Why don't their communities
you're going
in Central America and South America? Why don't the majority of
the
people there benefit from the natural resources that we benefit from their own from their resources? Why is it that American corporations and Canadian corporations and European corporations are the primary beneficiaries of natural resources
on
the continent of Africa, Central America, the Caribbean?
How about I ask you a question? You answer it succinctly.
No, answer it. Answer it.
Then you can ask me a question.
Answer it, genius. Answer it.
Answer the question. Why
they
came.
Answer mine. Answer my question.
And if I do, then you answer mine?
I just told you that. One of us, yes. Answer the question.
I've been answering it. I said their environment. What else?
It's a stupid answer. That's wrong. That's wrong. No.
That's a stupid answer.
Their land has been plundered. This has happened over.
So their environment had nothing to do with their becoming.
They have
a peasant background. Is that right, idiot?
They have had poverty imposed on them, genius. They have had poverty imposed on them.
God, you are a stupid person. You do not know how to answer questions. You do not know how to employ critical thinking.
All right. I'm a stupid person, and you're a nitwit, and I will talk to you later, all right? Actually,
yeah, go on with your little show.
Yes, and you're wasting your time. If this is a stupid show, you're the one that's tuning into it. So you can get off the program and you can go there and you can sit in front of your TV and just talk about how these immigrants have stolen so much from your American lifestyle and your comfort. You know, just sit back on that couch and rock back. And folks, actually, I didn't even have to hang up. He hung up on his own. Anyone who heard that, even if Sarah wants to call back and give her 2 cents, that's fine. But you know what? I'm glad that called. That is an example of Americanism. That's an example of Americanism. That is an example, a classic example of Americanism, to sit back there and to say these peasants. You heard the way he was talking. He was mm-hmm. referring to people, people that didn't look like him, referring to them as peasants. These folks are you know, they come from a peasant background, and they made themselves like that. And so, folks that are listening right now, if you did not know, all right, the guy that called in just now from Montana, he has, and this is an example of what Andre and I have been talking about, and this is a product of institutional racism, because it's individuals like that actually, unfortunately, are not just secluded in their homes on their recliners. They're actually in our school boards. They're on our school boards. They're in state capitals. They're in Capitol Hill. And they have this understanding of other people. And when you have this understanding of other people, when you have this understanding of other people, we cannot move forward as a society and bring about a true level playing field, as they always like to say, this a true egalitarian level playing field, because we cannot get away from the fact that people from Central America, people from South America, and yes, we definitely know people from countries like Congo, in Africa are to this day, not in the past, continue to have their natural resources robbed and plundered. And we look at even Haiti. Haiti's an example, folks, because it should be still on our radar because they're still going through hell. But the reason why Haiti did not have a whole bunch of first responders after January 12th, the same way if there was a major earthquake in the U.S., we would have first responders from other states coming in to help out and this, that, and the other. Haiti had no first responders with no infrastructure for that. Why? Why? Tell them why, Andre. You know the story. Going back to 1804. But what was Haiti rewarded with for fighting for their liberation and their freedom from Europeans, from the French, and even the U.S.? What were they rewarded for? And, you know, going, you know, lay it out for us, Andre, and then getting to what they did to the rice farmers.
Well, obviously, you know, Haiti was, in the Western Hemisphere, was the only country to have a successful slave revolt. And so that, you know, that was just the beginning for Haiti. The U.S. obviously did not want that to be an example for African people enslaved in the United States, the same in Latin America. So they imposed a lot of embargoes, you know, similar to what's happened with Cuba. And then, you know, later in Haiti's history with the World Bank and the IMF, the structural adjustment programs, where, you know, rice farmers can no longer compete with rice that's being imported from the United States, from agribusiness in the U.S. that subsidized millions of dollars a year, where, you know, these small farmers in Haiti are not being subsidized. And so they can no longer sell or compete with the U.S. rice being imported, and they're out of business. And so that's just another example of how it's not about people not wanting to work hard enough. It's about institutional policies that are imposed on countries that prevent people from having their subsistence. And you know, there has been an influx of Haitian immigrants before the earthquake due to that. And the same thing, you know, you can say that has occurred in a number of countries in Latin America. So it hasn't just been a military push, you know, that went through Latin America and forced people literally out of their homes, but also the economic policies, the free trade agreements, the free zones that we see in Jamaica and in Haiti, where U.S. corporations or European corporations are allowed to come in and, you know, they don't have to abide by labor laws, completely take advantage of the workers, pay them far less than even the minimum wage in the United States, to the point where either you continue working in these factories or you move. And usually that place is ironically to the United States or to Europe, the countries that have created these problems. And then once you get there, you are othered once again as an immigrant, as an outsider, as an alien, invader, when in reality, had your country not been invaded, you wouldn't have had to leave in the first place.
Right. And so we have another caller real quick, and I don't know who this is. So once again, it's an unidentified number. We'll see if it's our I'm not even going to use the – yeah. We'll see who it is. Caller, you're on the line.
Hey, Solomon, this is Sarah calling back in for that other caller that you had to boot off the line real quickly. You see, this is why we have ignorance in this country, this patrilineal type of attitude that he displayed on your show today. This is why they don't know a darn thing. America is the dumbest country walking around because of idiots like him. He needs to listen to John Perkins, the economic hitman, and he laid out the whole scenario about what they have been going around the country, the world doing is with these countries, blackmailing them into giving it up, or if you don't give it up, we're going to come in here and we're going to invade you because if we can't get you to the invasion, then we're going to take your behind out. They did that in Nicaragua, El Salvador, all of these countries they have came to and they have done it. They did it in Asia as well as now they're working on the African continent. These people have never seen something that they don't want to pay for. This country has destabilized. They did this with Jamaica too. Jamaica was the same. All these countries in the Caribbean, they have destabilized them and put them into so much debt with the IMF and the World Bank. That is why they are broke. And when these people are coming across the borders to get jobs because you went over there and you destabilized their country with these cheap goods, now you're telling them, oh, but we don't want you to come over here and take jobs. This country, they need to remember what happened to the Romans and the Greeks. They are a figment, and the Etruscans, they are a figment of what they once were. The same thing is going to this country. This country is already flat, broke, and busted any doggone way. They're all Chinese. You might as well start learning to speak Chinese, you damn idiot. Because you, the United States, China owned this country.
Yeah, you're right. Yep. Lock, stock, and barrel, exactly. And they predict that by 2016, that recent report that just came out, they predict that by 2016, China will surpass the U.S. in terms of its GDP. You know.
Which is true, because remember the British used to have the same thing, the sun doesn't set in the empire. They don't have an empire now. The United States is scrambling to get an empire by going through Africa and trying to split up the countries. Why the Africans are so destabilizing the Congo or whatever? Because y'all manufacture artificial arguments for these people, like religion, ethnicity, tribal conflicts. Y'all create this conflict, throw a rock and hide your hands and let the people fight amongst themselves, and then y'all collect the spoils. That's what Europeans have been doing around the globe, and that's what you're doing on the continent as well as in Asia right now with what's going on over there, putting one group against the other. So you can sit back in your TV and be comfortable. Look at the back of your doggone TV. I'm sure it says made in China.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right. And, Sarah, you bring up a good point, Sarah, when you talk about how these countries came to be in for Africa, like, because I'm sure with that last caller, we must have a lot of callers that probably, you know, have had the same kind of lack of education or miseducation that he's had. And you know, it's one thing to be miseducated. It's another thing to enjoy, you know, being as ignorant as you are. And clearly he really was basking in his ignorance. But, folks, you know, as Sarah was saying, you know, it was 1884. There was something called the Berlin Conference, and it started in 1884 and ended in 1885. And that's when Europeans, without any consultation with any African at all, they met at a conference in Berlin, and they literally cut up. So when you see these, the name Nigeria, and all these borders that you see today, all these little borders, they were carved up by Europeans. They carved them up so that they could go in there and exploit them. And they went in there and they set up shop. The Portuguese went in places like Angola and Mozambique and Cape Verde and Guinea-Bissau. The French went to Gabon and Senegal.
Mm-hmm.
And the English went to Kenya and Sudan and
South Africa.
So many other places. And they cut it up and they put the people in indentured servitude. They worked them brutally. They killed
mm-hmm.
them. Raped their women.
Millions.
They did this routinely.
Which is true, as you were saying, Brother Solomon. They put people in their cars up borders and put people who were enemies to each other. They were sharing borders with each other. Put tribes into areas they shouldn't have any business to be in. They went ahead in the Congo. The Belgium took the Congo for themselves, and that is why Mussolini tried to invade Ethiopia in order to take Ethiopia, because they didn't get anything in the spoils. So they tried to come into Ethiopia and Libya and try to take that for themselves. So you need to learn your history and learn what your people have done and the confusion that they have created. Why are you sitting all fat, dumb, and happy, thinking that, oh, but your wife's a basket in the glow of white supremacy? You're about to be toppled. You're not going to stay for long, because karma of the universe is not going to allow this imbalance to continue. That is why you're seeing these massive destructions around the globe with all of this natural disaster. Mother Nature, Mother Earth is taking revenge. And when she decides to have a bowel movement and put everything out there, you're going to find yourself in a world of hurt, because y'all didn't see nothing yet. This year is just doing a hiccup right now.
Right. Thank you so much, Sarah. That's exactly right. Thank you for calling back.
Oh, you're so welcome, Brother Scotty and Andre. You just keep giving them hell. They need to be put into hell. Y'all like burning up so much.
Right.
Take it in the sun. Hell is a good place for y'all to be, so y'all can toast yourself.
Right. Thank you. That's my comrade right there. Thank you for calling out again.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, she's so right. And the thing is, you know, because I know Sarah is still listening, Andrea, is that what's interesting is that, you know, I don't know the living conditions of that kind of cause, but there's a lot of people that have, a lot of white folks that have the same positions that he has, or, you know, even more regressive. And Andrea, they're living at the same time, you know. And what stimulated me to think about this is what Sarah just had to say, is that they're living in trailer parks. They have no insurance. They might have somebody in their family that needs to get a root canal, needs to get some kind of even medical, you know, surgery or something like that. They don't have the money to do it. Why? Because they live in a country where the people that they support, and that's the thing, so even within their own communities, Andrea and Sarah, even in their own communities, they have been divided and they are being conquered. Mm-hmm. Because the reason why their kids are gonna probably continue to live the same impoverished lives as they are, all right, if they're in the Appalachians or something like that, or somebody, you know, or they don't have access to health care, is because the people that they have received their marching orders for have the best health insurance, Andrea, and have the best salaries and live in some of the most opulent, well-resourced communities, period. Period. And so meanwhile, and they will tell them, oh, you know, you don't need socialism, you don't need such and such, and then say, you know, and then create the boogeyman. And the boogeyman before, you know, and it still is the blacks. And now the boogeyman is the immigrants. When we're talking about immigrants, we're not talking about Eastern Europeans, Western Europeans, Canadians. You know, when they say immigrants, they're talking about Mexicans or Central Americans or South Americans. That's the boogeyman. So they throw that distraction out there, knowing that they have a very limited and half-witted perspective on things. And so they're like, oh yeah, it's them. And so they run around thinking that it's the immigrants, just like that guy that called in, Andrea. It's the immigrants that are bringing these communities down and taking my resources. But let alone, shoot, it was these immigrants last year that contributed $11 billion in taxes, state tax, because we have to understand federal taxes just amount for a small portion of all taxes, state taxes, sales taxes. They attack or much larger. But my point is, Andrea, is that if America truly was a more socialist democracy, if it was a socialist democracy, period, like we see in places like Norway or even Germany, all right, Venezuela, they would have health care. No? Yeah, they would have health care. Their children, all they would have to do is score well on their high school examinations, and they would be able to go to college for free, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you really have to take a dimensional approach to this. You can't just see this as people are coming to invade your community. I can't stress enough how, you know, U.S. foreign policy has affected other countries and how that is directly related to immigration trends to this country. And, you know, beyond that, like, the people are here. There's about 12 million undocumented immigrants here. So, like, what are we going to do about it? You know, and the gentleman that called earlier was talking about...
Wait, stop. Take the word, the guy that called. The gentleman he has not earned that title, gentleman. The dude that called.
Okay, the guy that called was talking about that, you know, these people are uneducated, and it almost seemed like his argument is like there's no point in putting money into these schools because money has been put in and they're still not educated. Well, I mean, it's a fact that schools in immigrant communities and black and Latino communities are underfunded. But beyond that, like, it's not like, you know, this group of people cannot be educated. They're facing other issues. If you were to place yourself in that situation where you had to flee your country and you don't know the language in another country, imagine what that would be like. Now, I just want to say that from personal experience with working with the immigrant community, from not just Latin America, but from Ethiopia, Somalia, you know, a lot of Caribbean countries. We have a lot of Haitian women coming in too. People are trying to learn. We have an English program, and a lot of organizations in D.C. do have English classes at night, in the morning, on the weekends to accommodate, because a lot of these people work, you know, off hour shifts. And so they have to come in on their spare time. And I talk to a lot of these women who do make the effort to learn English. So So it is beyond that. It's not about people not wanting to, you know, be able to participate productively in this community. It's about they're facing multiple issues that the majority of Americans, especially white Americans, are not facing. And so you really have to see it for what it is, and not just that people are coming in to take jobs. I do want to address, however, and I think this is what you were talking about earlier, that, you know, the white working class doesn't even realize how they're getting gypped, because they're eating up this whole blacks, you know, are taking our jobs, and then immigrants are coming and stealing our jobs, and we have to compete with them, instead of realizing that the CEOs of these corporations are the ones who are really benefiting from this, and everyone is at a loss. And if we would work together, and particularly for the white working class, if they could get beyond their racist ideologies, they could organize as a working class to challenge the upper class and demand for the ability to ask for fair wages or to have health care or all these benefits that the upper class has and more.
Yeah, you're right. And so I want to play a clip from another clip from Barr, but it's these kind of, I mean, it's so important to have these dialogues, because it's clear that this education is not permeating itself in America's public schools. It's state-sanctioned public schools. And so the curriculum, in terms of a social studies class, which could really bring about compassion and understanding, not obfuscating things and putting out falsehoods, but bring about compassion by putting out actual factual information. The factual information is what she just talked about. These are things that you don't hear. We haven't heard American president talking about this ever. Okay. Period. U.S. foreign policy, you know, U.S. foreign policy. I mean, even when you look at, you know, people who mark, you know, FDR as, like, you know, one of the most progressive, you know, presidents of all time, you have to, you know, say relatively progressive. Yeah, he did some good things with the New Deal and those types of things. But even when it came to foreign policy, he showed his mettle in terms of his true mettle in terms of when even, you know, talking about Somoza, I mean, referring to it, that's our son of a bitch. That's our son of a bitch. This guy was a brutal dictator. Brutal dictator. The U.S. loves dictators, and that's why it's amusing when we hear this talk about the U.S. you know, wanting to take down dictators and this, that, and the other. As if, for instance, they're the world's policemen. But I thought the U.S. loved dictators. Because they support them. They support them, and I supported them for such a long time. And yes, this is also connected to institutional racism, white supremacy, and imperialism. It is. When you look at the countries where they support these brutal dictators, I mean, they're mostly countries of where people are brown skinned or black skinned, you know, Central America, South America, the Middle East, Africa, you know, so yeah, if you want to, you know, start pointing fingers and blaming, you know, certain, you know, folks as dictators, then you need to look who's propped up these folks, who has propped up these folks, you know, who has completely propped up these folks. And I think that Glenn Ford, you know, has a brilliant take on this, on you know, in relationship to looking at Libya right now, and also, and I'm going to say this right now before we go to this clip. And I want everyone to listen. And this is probably something, as Sarah listens right now, something that she's probably has talked about. And Sarah, I want you to keep fighting the good fight. Keep, just, you know, putting that information out there to folks to heighten their specter of consciousness. All right? They may take the blue pill. They may not. But we don't know until we offer that blue pill. Now, when we, you know, when we look at U.S. global domination, and when we look at yesterday, all right, just last night, I'm not going to make any defense of Osama bin Laden. You know what I'm saying? Whether he's in hell roasting right now, I don't care any shape, form, or fashion. All right, he doesn't represent, and I'm not Muslim, but he doesn't represent all Muslims any more than David Duke you know, or Hitler represent all Christians, okay? The point of the matter is that when we saw all these Americans in the streets celebrating this last night, Andrea, you know, in front of the White House, on college campuses, holding up signs, the American flag, just waving it. Yeah, ding dong, the witch is dead. Okay? The point, and first of all, I believe Obama, I mean, I believe Osama bin Laden. I believe Osama bin Laden was killed long before last night. And there's a reason why they dumped his body in the water, you know, and we're going to be having Stephen Lindman on and within the next week, who's done a lot of research around this, going to be talking about this. But beyond that, where is it, folks? It's like a serial killer just killed another serial killer. It's like Jeffrey Dahmer just killed John Wayne Gacy, or it's like John Wayne Gacy just killed Andrew Cunanan, all right? Or Ted Bundy, you know, killing, the Ted Kaczynski, you know. So it still leaves you. Ted Bundy still standing there, alive and well. The U.S., if what happened on 9/11, which, yes, we had close to 3,000 lives killed in one fell swoop, and it was a tragedy, and it was a day marked in infamy, and God bless all the families who lost loved ones on that day. But what the U.S. did in retaliation, they went ahead. And they went and they did a military strike in Afghanistan. And folks, you best believe that the U.S. and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when before they did this, you best believe that they knew that as they start to do their first strikes in retaliation, that they knew that they would be taking out civilians. They knew it. And they took out as many, if not more, civilians in their first airstrikes in Afghanistan than were taken out by al-Qaeda on 9/11. And since then, we've seen tens of thousands of Afghanis and now Pakistanis who have been killed because of U.S. manless drones, as well as airstrikes, as well as ground troopers going into villages and killing folks, all right, killing villagers. We've seen that, you know. We know that this is fact. And we see a million-plus Iraqis, civilians. I'm not talking about so-called insurgents or al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda wasn't even there until the U.S. got there, but that's another story. I'm talking about civilians. Over a million Iraqi civilians have been killed. So this is where we are, folks, with America. This is where your job comes in, to raise the specter of conscience and having those difficult conversations and pushing them pushing the envelope conversation-wise to loved ones and community members and so forth, is that it is pretty pathetic. Americans can go out there and celebrate the death of Osama bin Laden at the same time not mourning the deaths of innocent civilians. Because when they're celebrating the death of Osama bin Laden, they're celebrating the death because of how many American lives he was responsible for taking on 9/11. Okay, so what about the discussion and what about protesting your government for the taking of innocent civilian lives 10,000 miles, 8,000 miles across the world? Is it maybe because Afghanis and Iraqis, their lives are not the same as Americans? Are they expendable? Because otherwise, if you're not going to do those things, then you're a damn hypocrite. You're a bloody hypocrite. A bloody hypocrite, and you stand for absolutely nothing. It means nothing to you. So I don't want to hear the conversation that you care about innocent lives being taken if you are not furthering the conversation and saying, yes, I'm glad Osama bin Laden is dead, but I am upset that my country's military, or the country I reside in's military, has taken more civilian lives. It shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be an eye for an eye. But nothing. Did you see any of that last night?
No. I mean, there really is no other explanation. The lives of 500,000 Iraqi children are just not valued the same as the life of an American child. And, I mean, the fact that, you know, people are celebrating it, like you said, it doesn't concern me. I'm not in no way defending Osama bin Laden, but you can't celebrate it because you're glad or somehow it brought justice to these 3,000 lives or deaths that were taken away in 9/11 without thinking about the 500,000 Iraqi children that have been killed. And honestly, the people who justify it, simply, it's just that they don't value the lives of other people, whether it's on a patriotic tip or I think, quite frankly, it comes down to race. You know, this is about race. Like, they are less important. When other people are dying in other countries, when we invade other countries and kill thousands of people or even just hundreds, it's collateral damage. Mm-hmm. So what if another country did that to the U.S.? What if Al-Qaeda called 3,000 American lives collateral damage? How would Americans respond to that? Would that be acceptable? Of course not. So why is it that we can call lives, whether it's in the Middle East, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, collateral damage? Do people realize that the United States has over 700,000 military bases? I don't know how many secret prisons around the world. You know, the Ecuadorian president, Rafael Correa, said, the United States can have a military base in my country when I can have a military base in Miami.
Maybe 700 military bases. You said 700,000.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I meant 700. I meant 700. And so, of course, the United States said no to President Correa because the U.S. would never allow any other country to have a military base on U.S. soil. But somehow it's acceptable for them to have a military base in practically every country. I mean, it's just absurd. And then you ask yourself, why does terrorism exist? So what do you call having a military base in other countries and having access to these military bases, basically running them, training military personnel on U.S. property impose whether it's economic or political gains for the United States in other countries? What do you call that? That is terrorism. What do you call killing other people, dropping bombs in a number of places? That is terrorism. So as 9/11, as tragic as 9/11 was, I don't think any of us, either you or myself, want to downplay what happened because, you know, it definitely was a tragedy. But that happens over and over and has been happening since the United States has existed. That has been the agenda of the United States. The United States was born on terrorism, from the genocide of indigenous people to the enslavement of African people to creating wars all around the world. So you just have to call it what it is. There's no way to go around it. If killing 3,000 American lives in that act was terrorism, then so is bombing countries with no concern for civilian lives.
Yep, you're exactly right. And we until we start to think about these things and push these conversations, there's no change. All right. If people get together and they actually start to have these conversations and it starts to positively metastasize from one community to the next, and people get out in the streets en masse, like on a consistent basis, get out in the streets en masse, and demand just rugged, radical change in terms of U.S. foreign policy, because it's needed. It's not like something that, you know, we're pushing, you know, our agenda. This is, when you're pushing that kind of agenda to have a radical change in U.S. Military or U.S. foreign policy, you're on the side of humanity. You're trying to change it for the better. We're talking about changing it, scaling it down, and demanding that these military bases start to be shut down, you know, bit by bit by bit by bit. You have to visualize. You have to be a visionary and see these things in order to start to work towards them. If you don't see these things happening, it makes your job that much easier. I mean, that much more difficult, I should say. All right? You have to visualize these things. You have to visualize them because otherwise you're going to continue to see your tax dollars, if you're paying federal taxes, 54% of your tax dollars go towards military without any say whatsoever. So at the same time, when the U.S. is spending you know, $1 trillion in military for military purposes every single year, and has the audacity to tell American citizens, those that don't have health insurance, that they cannot afford a single payer health system, that they're lying to you. They're lying to you. And they're lying to you because they know they can probably get away with it because you have been programmed in their state-sanctioned educational systems the same way your parents have. Your parents are probably reinforcing everything that these you know, amoral politicians are putting out there. We got to start thinking about these things. The reason we did this show, you know, and I knew we're gonna get into this because but it's all connected though. When we looking at racial markers, yeah, race was a social construct. We know that. But the reason why it's important for us not to look at race as a thing of the past, because a lot of white liberals and white conservatives alike, on the surface, they'll say, we don't want to address race. We want to look at everyone as a human being. And the reason they want to do that is because their nefarious plan is that when you stop looking at race, when you completely stop looking at race in the society we live in, that is of the haves and the have-nots, and you look at society as like a race-blind society, while at the same time you have such disparities, many of which are based on race, then, in essence, you can't, Andrea, you cannot attack those problems. Right now, race has to be used because it is a demarcation marker for these disproportionalities. You can't fix the prison industrial complex without, yes, obviously looking at capitalism, but you can't address the institutional racist component of the prison industrial complex without looking at the disproportionality of the 13% of African Americans that are incarcerated, but yet they represent 50% of the prison population. All right? You can't. You can't. All right? Yes, in George Bush's fuzzy math world, yeah, that could work. But in the real world, that doesn't work in any shape, form, or fashion. All right? You can't look at blacks making 60 cents for every dollar that a white person gets without taking a hard, long, hard look at institutional racism. Let me take a break for a second, and instead of music, we're going to listen to the fine tunes of Glenn Ford's unique voice and tenor and just the uncanny way he has of dropping knowledge and wit at the same time. This is we were talking international politics, so let's keep it international for a moment.
The official Euro-American invasion of Libya is about to begin. I say official invasion because the Europeans and Americans already have boots on the ground making bloody footprints in Libya, from U.S. Special Ops and CIA, British Special Air Services commandos, and their French counterparts. The news media of the invader countries know their armed forces are active on Libyan soil, and occasionally they report as much. But they dutifully await announcements from their governments that the real invasion has officially begun. That time is near. The British announced they are sending a 10-man military advisor team to help the rebels. The French, who were obscenely quick to recognize the rebels' so-called National Transitional Council as a kind of government, already have military advisors in Benghazi. The American CIA and the Saudi Arabians are thought to be truly in on the ground floor, having sponsored and financed Khalifa Haftar, the Libyan exile who formed the so-called Libyan National Army that has been trying to mount an armed revolt against the government in Tripoli for more than 20 years. The mass ground assault may well commence with the imminent deployment of the European Union's so-called battle groups, multinational military units of about 1,500 men each. The 27-nation European Union have been discussing ways to insinuate a force into Libya since the beginning of April. Unexpectedly, Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi agreed in principle to allow international humanitarian personnel to aid civilians in the contested port city of Misrata. Quickly, the Europeans seized on Gaddafi's statement as an excuse to send up to 1,000 men on an assignment that could only be accomplished by a large ground military force operating with close air support. The EU battle group would secure the port facilities, which are now held by rebels, and then create land corridors into and out of the city, much of which is held by loyal Gaddafi soldiers whose lines would have to be crossed. Remembering that once you give the former colonialist an inch, he will take your whole country, Colonel Gaddafi vowed that he would fight any foreign soldiers that attempted to land on Libyan territory, no matter what they claimed their mission was. The European scheme is transparently cynical. They seek to land a battle group in Misrata under humanitarian pretenses and then inevitably clash with Gaddafi soldiers dug in nearby. That will be the beginning of the Europeans' multinational land invasion, with thousands of troops arriving in Libya in short order. The siege of Tripoli will begin if the regime holds out, and if not, then begins the guerrilla war, or as the Euro-Americans like to call it when they steal someone else's country, the insurgency. The U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, used to worry about getting permission to open an office on African soil. Soon, it may be operating from one of the largest countries on the continent. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
That was Glenn Ford. As I said, he's always educational and always, you know, entertaining. But, you know, there's a lot of seriousness that goes into what he was talking about. And when we talk about Libya, which is something that we'll get into with Stephen Lindman soon. So pay attention to that. That interview is coming out soon. But if you want to see actually one of an interview that Stephen Lindman, was a little 5-minute interview he did today on RT, you can just go to our website, go to yourworldnews.org, and go to and then click on the blog section where it says blogs on yourworldnews.org. Click on blogs, and then when you go there, click on where it says geopolitical videos, and the first one should be Stephen Lindman. And, you know, he's breaking. Did you get a chance to see it today?
No.
Yeah, but it's on point. But, yeah, this whole thing, like, Americans running around, you know, wanting, you know, to ouster Gaddafi, it's like a complete joke, man, for humanitarian reasons. And just, it's really scary. I mean, it's really scary how mentally obsequious Americans are, and they're unable to think for themselves. And Libya, most Americans can't even point Libya on a map, let alone give a damn, you know what I'm saying, what has been going on in Libya or any place else, for that matter. So for them to run around and say, oh, you know, this guy is a dictator, he's been doing X, Y, and Z, they don't. First of all, they couldn't care less. They're saying that because that's what the media told them.
Mm-hmm.
And the government that is in bed with the media, corporate media, they got together and they told them to tell them, you know, and that's how it goes down, folks, and that's how it goes down, you know, because when you want to look at the range of things in terms of people in the Maghreb, which is northern Africa, you know, Libya is not in the Middle East, but you want to look in the Maghreb or even in the Middle East and that range of the world, the most brutal and repressive government in that range of the world begins with an I, all right? And then the second letter is an S, all right? And you probably know where I'm going. The last letter is an L. Israel is the most brutal and repressive government in that area. If when you look at what they have been doing and continue to do to Palestinians on stolen land that was stolen, going back to the Balfour Declaration, under the guise of Britain, the Brits, supported by the Americans all the way. It is absolutely inhumane. There are people that are born today in Palestine. I'm talking about West Bank and Gaza. But like, just let's take a look at Gaza, that are born today. There are children that are born today that if things do not change, they will live in poverty. They will have no chance. And based on that nitwit that called before, I guess they could just pull themselves up with their bootstraps. But no, if you're born into a country or a community that is devoid of any kind of resources, all right, the people in Palestine cannot even control their own water. They cannot control their electricity. They get about 6 hours per day. Unemployment, 70% around. Are you kidding me? And this doesn't include the bombs that have been shelled upon them. Okay? And let's take a look. If you want to talk about, oh, well, there were mortar fires, you know, there was long sustaining. Let's take a look. Let's talk to Americans. How many Americans would sit back idly if another country was doing that to Montana or was doing that to California? Hell no. You think Americans would be talking about taking up arms and exercising their Second Amendment rights and using those guns and forming the militias and this, that, and the other? Are you kidding me? It might look like something like the throwback '80s movie Wolverines, you know. So we have to understand this, all right? We're either going to stand on the side of justice or we're not going to stand at all. But you can't pick and choose. You don't have the luxury to pick and choose. I'm going to say it. Just like you're not entitled to your own, you are entitled to your own opinions, but you cannot create your own facts. You are not entitled to your own facts. Not on this show, and not in the real world, you're not. No way, no way whatsoever. No way Joe. Some people say no way Jose, but I'm going to say Joe, because in this case, no way Joe. Joe the plumber, all right? And there's tens of millions of Joe the plumbers out there that I'm talking to right now. You can't create your own. You cannot create your own facts. As we draw to a close, we almost have to do a part two of this, Andrea, because time has eluded us, and unfortunately, we spent too much of that time on someone who just, you know, by his own definition, just has allowed the facts to elude him. You know, as we talk, as Glenn said, with the white flag, this guy was flying far away from the truth, which means he cannot be set free. Any last words, comments before I might let Malcolm take us out today.
I guess I'll just go. You know, I just wanted to point out something that's current right now as well with the attack on education. The House Bill 2218. That happened in Arizona that banned ethnic studies, primarily Mexican-American or Chicano studies. And another bill, well, I mean, there's a lot of bills going on in different states. The one in Texas where they completely water down and almost take completely out slavery or anything that has to do with African-American culture or any culture that's not white. And so the education system is not only deteriorating because certain schools aren't funded, but the type of education that we're getting in textbooks. And I find it interesting that the argument for this ethnic studies ban is that it'll create divisions and tension towards white students. But was there ever any consideration about how textbooks that only portray European history as, you know, the right, like that they've done everything right, and the conquest of the Americas as something good. Did they ever consider that that created divisions and that othered the people who were, quote, conquered, or how that could, you know, offend, and beyond offending, like just completely give no context to what actually occurred. So it's, with a lot of people, I feel like it's not just ignorance, it's how are we allowing these things to happen in our schools, and what does this mean for the children that are going to be learning in these schools in the future? How are they going to understand our country? You know?
Right, and that's a good, I have nothing to add. I'll let Malcolm take it, I guess that's a good segue, and talking about history, and let's have a little history. Put your thinking caps on and pull up to your desk and pull out your number two pencil and take some notes, because Professor Malcolm X is going to teach us a little something. Until next time, I'm Solomon, and joined once again by the managing editor for Your World News.
I'm Andrea.
And once again, rest in peace and God bless my friend and comrade, Brother Fadari Abdul Ali, and his family.
Imagine the white man telling you and me that Africa is a jungle, and everything over there is backwards. And if you go over there, you won't like the living conditions. How are they living over there? Why, we got to fight them over there to get them out. If there's nowhere over there, why don't they get out of there? Why did Lumumba have to fight to get the Belgians out of the Congo? Because the Congo is one of the most beautiful places on this earth. If it wasn't beautiful, the white man wouldn't be there. You got the white man all over there. He's everywhere over there, living like a king. But they're getting ready to send him. Send him. No, it's not a jungle. It's civilized. It's cultured. It's developed. It's intelligent. High moral, high everything, good people, friendly people, hospitable people, brother to a brother. That's how they kidnapped us. We were too hospitable. We saw the old white man coming over the hill, and we accepted him into our city as a friend. And he shipped us down the river, sold us into bondage. This is one of the greatest mistakes that our people made, opening their doors in hospitality to the white man. And when we first saw him coming, we should have sent him then. And we never would have had to catch the hell we've been catching over here in America for the past 400 years. When he came to Africa, he came from the jungle to civilization. Because the jungle was in Europe. Savages were in Europe. Cannibals were in Europe. Cannibals weren't in Africa. Cannibals were in Europe. White people were up to eating each other up. They still eat each other up. You've seen these berries and things running around here. Other white people. That's the way they live. They're cannibals. They're savages. They have no morals. A low-down, filthy race. The most filthy race on this earth. They used to live in the caves. They walked on their all fours. They were naked like animals. They couldn't walk upright. They didn't wear clothes. They didn't cook their food. Why, they ate raw meat. They still like their meat raw. 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 That's the dog in them, brother. That's the animal in them, brother. No, they're a race of cave dwellers. Didn't know how to bury their dead. For 2,000 years, they lived up in the caves of Europe. And during that time, you and my people were living in luxury, living with high culture, living in a high civilization. Why, Africa is the root of civilization. Africa is the home of civilization. Africa has been civilized a long time. They have all kinds of civilizations in Africa. They have the Egyptian civilization, the Carthaginian civilization, the Mali Empire, the empires of Benin, of Mali, Songhai. Why, you can call out empires all day long from the African continent that were in a high state of culture when these blue-eyed things were crawling around up in Europe, living in huts, eating raw meat. I love to talk about it. I do. I love to talk about it. Yes, I love to talk about it. Talk about them like a dog. And they should be able to take it. Now they know how we feel. Why, when I was a little boy, they called me nigger so much, I thought that was my name. That's all they knew how to call you. Now they get an inkling of how we feel, and the chickens that they sent out there are coming home to roost. They are a race of cave dwellers, raw meat eaters, naked, no clothes wear. That's where they came from. They are not fit to be walking around here telling you to look like they do. Boy, you could take them. No, they learn civilization from you. They learn culture from you. They learn how to wear clothes from you. They learn how to cook their food from you. They learn mathematics from you. They learn science from you. Why, the black man in Africa had mastered the arts and sciences way back yonder. He mastered the mathematical sciences, the astronomical sciences, to the extent where he could plot the course of the stars in the universe when this old white, blue-eyed thing didn't even know that the earth was round. He just found out the earth was round.